We've been taking our good, slow walk through the New Testament book of Romans for more than 5 months now. And I wanted to ask a question. We happen to be getting to chapter 11, beginning at about verse 13. To whom has the apostle Paul been speaking most directly so far? And who's his audience? I mean, I realize he's writing to the whole group at Rome. But there's a sense in which he's been addressing a portion of that group pretty specifically so far. Who are they? I've talked about it. He's addressing a certain group of the Jewish readers pretty directly for quite a while now. The bulk of the first 10 or 11 chapters has been addressing what could have been a problem among them, or was, I'm sure. A problem among them, a wrongful use of the Old Testament law. I do imagine that it's important, though, to remember that the Lord had inspired him to address those with lessons then that are core lessons for us all. We learn about our salvation. We learn what to avoid. We learn what to avoid with regard to mistaken thinking about the commands of God, His law. They really do address things that deal with us at the core of who we are. And keep us on the right track. I remember in Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, he talked like this. You know, you've got, the Lord chose to give us Scripture in a certain way. And there are major parts of this that are an account of the Israelites' dealings with God. How they operated, how they received his commands and dealt with him, how he dealt with them. We get a lot of narrative, and that was God's way of communicating with us. Paul happened to comment on an aspect of that, 1 Corinthians 10, about verse 6. These things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on the evil things they did, that they set their hearts on. That's only part of the picture, obviously, and there's a great cloud of witnesses of faith, as well as this sort of warning that we not set our hearts on evil things as they did. But it does seem to indicate that as the writers in Scripture, the New Testament writers, as they address issues that were before them, though they are addressing specific people under specific circumstances. Actually really most important to remember that they are addressing real people, specific circumstances. But why? Because these are core issues. They're going to address us where we need to have our understanding about our salvation touched upon. 1 Corinthians 10:11 reads this way, these things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us, on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come. So Israel's life, a lot of Israel's life becomes lesson to us. And it does in Romans as well. Interestingly, just this point where we're getting to in Romans, you'll find that the apostle directly addresses his Gentile readers now. He's been talking to his Jewish readers, and the Gentiles have been readers of this all along. It's a letter to the folks there, both Jew and Gentile. But he's going to turn his attention now to Gentile readers with a lesson and a potential correction again, a potential bad attitude they might have had to correct them. And I think it's worth listening and saying what issues of the heart are being addressed here. And of course, the correction is both correction and good news. The human race is prone to a self-centered, self-made religion. We're prone to pride in lots of things. You'll see specifics today. But the truth is much better news. It's not only it's correction, but it's also refreshing, good news and matters for praise for God. So we'll talk about that. Again, he addresses his Gentile readers. The first words out of the gate, Romans 11:13, are going to be, I'm talking to you Gentiles. Okay, so interesting. This is a dynamic within their group. How do people relate to people, and how does all that relate to our salvation in Rome? So he says, I'm talking to you Gentiles here for a moment. Just one more word of context, and that is that the material has been kind of leading up to this. Like you can see him, he's going to get to addressing the Gentiles, because in a sense he's been asking this question. Okay, Israel, you consider Israel with all the evidence in their history, with all the evidence right then at the time of Christ of all their stubbornness and hardness of heart. Are they beyond recovery? Is Israel, have they gone beyond recovery? And Gentiles, what ought you to think of all this? You know, mercy has come to you just now. A real unfolding of mercy to you. How ought you to regard all this? And how ought you to regard them? How ought you to regard those Jews? So, let's read. Romans 11, 13, I'll read to the end of the chapter. I'm talking to you Gentiles. Inasmuch as I'm an apostle to the Gentiles, I make much of my ministry in the hope that I may somehow arouse my own people to envy and save some of them. For if their rejection is the reconciliation of the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? If the part of the dough offered as first fruits is holy, then the whole batch is holy. If the root is holy, so are the branches. If some of the branches have been broken off, and you, though a wild olive shoot, have been grafted in among the others, and now share in the nourishing sap from the olive root, do not boast over those branches. If you do, consider this. You do not support the root, but the root supports you. You will say then, branches were broken off so that I could be grafted in. Granted, but they were broken off because of unbelief, and you stand by faith. Do not be arrogant, but be afraid, for if God did not spare the natural branches, he will not spare you either. Consider, therefore, the kindness and sternness of God. Sternness to those who fell, kindness to you, provided that you continue in his kindness. Otherwise, you will also be cut off. And if they do not persist in unbelief, they'll be grafted in, for God's able to graft them in again. After all, if you were cut out of an olive tree that's wild by nature and contrary to nature, were grafted into a cultivated olive tree, how much more readily will these, the natural branches, be grafted in to their own olive tree? I do not want you to be ignorant of this mystery, brothers, so that you may not be conceited. Israel has experienced a hardening in part until the full number of the Gentiles has come in, and so all Israel will be saved. As it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion. He will turn godlessness away from Jacob. This is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. As far as the gospel is concerned, they're enemies on your account, but as far as election is concerned, they are loved on account of the patriarchs. For God's gift and his call are irrevocable. Just as you were at one time disobedient to God. Just as you who were at one time disobedient to God have now received mercy as a result of their disobedience. So too they have now become disobedient in order that they too may now receive mercy as a result of God's mercy on you. For God has bound all men over to disobedience so that he may have mercy on them all. Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable His judgments and His paths beyond tracing out. Who's known the mind of the Lord? Or who's been His counselor? Who's ever given to God that God should repay him? For from Him and through Him and to Him are all things. To Him be glory forever. Amen. I meant to ask you before we started reading, just try to watch, try to begin to line up. What is this message? What is he trying to communicate to the Gentile believers there in Rome? I wonder if we could summarize it. This is not the only list one could make, but I wonder if we could summarize it under these five headings. It seems first that he is addressing their attitude toward the Jews. How do they regard these people? And it's sad to say, but I think in his Gentile readers, there was some disdain for the Jews. Number two, I think what he's addressing what could be called a sort of an entitlement mindset or something with these Gentile readers. They had processed two factors wrongly, perhaps. They saw the rejection of many Jews. Well, them rejecting God, but God, you know, having them under this discipline, this time of even a hardening of their hearts. There's a season that's obvious to them there. They had processed that, and they had processed their own acceptance. They rejected, we accepted. They processed that in a wrongful way, and I could call it entitlement. It's interesting to me that Paul uses three words: boasting, arrogance, conceit. However they were thinking about their situation and its relationship to the Jews, they were erring in the matter of boasting, arrogance, and conceit. And he's dealing with them. Thirdly, I think Paul corrects them toward humility. He will show them why they ought to remain humble. And then fourthly, I think there's material in here that inspires a change of heart toward the Jews. I feel it not only in that mode of busting them for their error, their bad attitude, but I think there's something in there that says, do you see how this good grace works? And yes, they've been in error, but wouldn't it be a beautiful thing if, you know what I'm saying? I think there's something in there of that. So inspiration for a change of heart. And he ends with praise for God for the way the whole thing goes. This whole situation, there's praise for God. So their attitude toward the Jews, their entitlement mindset, a correction toward humility, inspiration for a change of heart toward the Jews, and praise for God in the end, those five things. So number one, their attitude toward the Jews. And I thought about this. Is this a characteristic sin among human beings? That we latch on to privileges granted and then somehow count ourselves superior for having them. Even when the privileges granted are gifts and undeserved, placed in a place of privilege, do people latch on to that and count themselves superior for being there? I wondered. And I wondered, this disdain for the Jews, how might it have formed in the Gentiles' minds? I think it's evident here. How might it have formed? Would it be something like this? You know, who do they think they are calling themselves the chosen ones? Ha, see how they have fallen. You know, Jews think themselves so righteous in comparison to us. Their attitude is always that we are the pagans and the unclean. They're so righteous. Yeah, well, They bring up the law all the time. See how Paul corrects them. Now, I don't know what they were thinking. I'm only tossing those out there as possibilities. But somehow, the words we have from Paul, he is somehow addressing them on a matter of boasting. And it is an us against them kind of boasting, because he talks about a boasting over them. Arrogance, conceit, those are the words he's dealing with. How does that come up in a situation like the Jew-Gentile relationship in the church at Rome? He seems to be addressing them. I want to simply say this about it. Boasting, arrogance, conceit, p- party against party, boasting over others. Those are spiritually crippling attitudes. And I want to examine my heart. Do I ever think that way about anybody? I'm boasting over. What, do we look upon ourselves as somehow more eligible for position with God than they? You know? More eligible for acceptance with God than they? Such a mindset is offensively out of accord with the very definition of this gospel. We ought rather to rejoice in another's place of favor with God and pray that they receive mercy in terms of knowing how much we fundamentally need it. Does that make sense? Rejoice that God would have mercy on so-and-so. You know, to rejoice over that. Why? Because I need mercy so badly and I've come to discover it. You know, just the way all history fell out. But Jews, Gentiles, the whole works. The way it all fell out. All the stubbornness. All the obstinance. Does that not reveal in my own heart my need for mercy? How ought I then to regard another? And what refreshing discovery it might be to begin to regard another with that kind of attitude. And I don't care who they are. You know what I'm saying? Even if there's a sense of animosity and enemy status with someone. And they, you know, some of these Jews were opposing the gospel of Christ in this season. What a refreshing thing to be saying, oh God, grant them the grace. Why? Because I know my own history of rebellion. I mean, I'm trying to make parallels all the way along to what the Gentile situation is. Do you see Paul saying to them, do you realize what's gone on here? You see a sternness of God upon rebellion. What are you going to do? What's the lesson you ought to learn when you see God's sternness against rebellion? Arrogance? Is that the lesson you're supposed to learn? Rather, you received mercy. I mean, in this dynamic, and it's pretty specific to this Jew-Gentile thing, but in this dynamic, they received mercy, in a sense, because of how God was dealing with his Jewish people. God was dealing with them to show them a lesson, turning his mercy away from them for a season, and giving it to others so they'd learn. And what were they supposed to learn? That they had not deserved, you know, the mercy they had been, their whole history, etc. But the Gentiles too, they've got to receive this lesson. I see them being dealt with sternly. I must remember that the whole issue with me is kindness. Boasting, arrogance, conceit have nothing to do with this. And we must remain in the mindset that this has been kindness to me and kindness alone. If we don't remain in that, I mean, what did that phrase throw you? You've got to continue in his kindness. How do you continue in somebody's kindness? Make sure you do that. Make sure you continue. You can't sort of make God be kind to you. How do you make that happen? I think it addresses them in their whole mindset. You've got to remember how this grace came to you. You've got to remain in that and embrace this by faith. Why did they fall? It was a matter of unbelief. I'm rattling on here, getting way away from the notes, but just kind of wandering through here. maybe a brief address of the entitlement mindset. Branches were broken off so that I could be grafted in. What is that a cause for arrogance? Is that a cause for conceit? Yeah, grafted in. You know, no, it's the cause for a whole different lesson. A whole different lesson. And he addresses them there. It's so fascinating to me about the Jew-Gentile relationship because their bad attitude toward the Jews offended the very essence of what they'd been saved into. It's as though Paul were saying to them, the salvation flows from there. It flows from God's kindness to those folks. God started there. And from and through them is blessing you. But you've got to understand, you're a grafted in branch. Why would you have a boasting over and against? I wonder if there was any kind of reveling in their fall. We have to just explore that. You know, in Paul's letter to the Ephesians, he urged Gentile readers to remember, before the shed blood of Christ came into this, you were excluded. That's the word he used. Before Christ's blood was shed, Ephesians 2:12, you were excluded. You were foreigners to the covenants of promise, without hope and without God in the world. The time of mercy is no time for boasting. With regard to correcting them to a wholesome humility, Paul reasoned with them with those words, "Consider therefore the kindness and sternness of God." What a phrase that is. Take a deep breath. You know, consider the kindness. And that's not meant to put despair in front of you. But it sure, you know, breaks up arrogance. And again, let me ask this. Again, what should they learn from having observed God's sternness with stubborn Israel, not arrogance? If they, listen to this reasoning, and this is a difficult portion, but an important portion and a helpful portion of this passage. If they, who were parties to the covenant, members of the only clan on earth that could be called the chosen nation of God, if they could be broken off from that olive tree, you see, it's an illustration, an olive tree. This is if they could be broken off of that, then so could you. You were associated with this tree at all by mercy. You were grafted in. Don't be prideful now. But it brings up a really important question. You know what question's brewing right about now? What question does this bring up? What's being described here? What was going on when an Israelite got broken off of the olive tree? Use the illustration. What's going on? Are we talking here about having had salvation and losing it? I don't think so. Let me tell you why. I think this is a helpful passage to distinguish between two important aspects of how God did deal with them, how he does deal with people in what we could call covenant relationship. And if you don't mind, I'm going to read instead of just kind of wing it like I often do, because I want to be precise as I can. The fact that God entered into a covenant relationship, and I'll define covenant relationship this way, stated promises sworn on oath. The fact that God entered into covenant relationship with Abraham and his descendants was a distinct mercy, definitely mercy upon them all. But in an important respect, it was external. An aspect of this is an external aspect. I mean, in one respect, it was not an act upon the heart. To enter into that covenant sworn promises to them, there's an aspect of that that is not yet an act upon their hearts. It held out good news to them and promises, and it held out the promises genuinely to Abraham and to his descendants. It set them apart from all the other peoples on the planet. They are of the tree in that respect. And in that regard, I could go so far as to say it was not inaccurate to call them the chosen people, the people of God. But in God's wisdom, and I think to highlight the grim reality of what proves itself to be their rebellion, and to make a lesson obvious for us, God ordained that only when a yet more penetrating mercy was exercised, only when there was a divine act upon the heart, a heart transplant, if you will, a divine act upon the heart, upon hearts which had were proving themselves to be made of stone, to make them new. Only when there was a gift of a new heart, only then would there be a kind of belonging to covenant mercy in its deepest and essential sense. Only then would one become what we could call a true member of the people of God, a true Jew, if you will. It's coming at you like a fire hydrant here. I don't know. Maybe hard to digest. But Paul's already written this way. A man is not a Jew if he's only one outwardly. No, a man's a Jew if he's one inwardly. It's the way he's written to them. And if the purification cannot only be outward and physical, it cannot only be a matter of the practice of external rituals, but it must be of the heart by the Spirit. That's chapter 2, verse 29. And in chapter 9, he had written, not all who are descendants from Israel are Israel. You see how he talks about a trueness of being within that. Identity with the tree, identity with the covenant people is a true blessing, but it's not the same as conversion, regeneration, salvation itself. But that tree will still show itself unfaithful. The people in it, the branches in it, will still show it themselves unfaithful. And the Lord has ordained that truest belonging, shall we say, requires a new heart. And I think it's in that light that we may understand how the idea that branches could be broken off, not that they already had salvation and eternal life and lost it, but they had covenant membership privileges which they spurned and from that were cut off. The same goes for a Gentile who would identify himself with the name and people of Jesus, because those people too are a people in covenant relationship. And one with an identity distinct from the world. There is a setting apart, and one could be associated with, I'm going to talk in New Testament, with the people of God in the New Testament. One could be associated with that, short of conversion. It is a covenant relationship. It's a high privilege. It's a blessing to be identified with it. Its promises hold out good news, and it holds out genuinely. And participation in some of its external things, very particularly baptism and communion. Participation in those things are covenant acts. You get identified. You get set apart from the rest of the world into this unit. But still, there's a difference between the external and the internal. People are not members of the assembly of the people of God, the church, if they are only ones outwardly. And if the purification is only outward and physical, only a splash of H2O, only a crust of bread, one is only of God, of his people, really and inwardly, only set apart in the ultimate way when it is a work of the Spirit, nothing short of being born again. Well, I went on that with longer than I thought. And I hope that makes some sense. It's hard to know from up here whether that's making sense, because it's just it's a bulk of material. But I think it's a helpful passage. There is such a thing as being associated with the covenant people that is not itself that inward change of heart. From the external association, there can be a breaking off. And he wanted them to understand that, I think. What about inspiration for a change of heart toward the Jews? I think the great seed for that is the humility that could be born of a recognition of what all had happened. I've already talked about this some. As you observe stubbornness in the Jewish people, it will be good, you Gentiles, to recall your own history of stubbornness. And as God has had mercy on you at this time, can't you think that it might be a beautiful thing for him to turn and have mercy on them? Are they beyond recovery? That's an interesting part of this. You've got a distinct body of people related to all the promises and all of that, and you've got this grafting in of these others. What about those folks and all associated with that? Are they beyond recovery? Paul says, not at all, not even remotely. How natural a thing it would be for a Jew to embrace Christ. Could a Jew look backward to the promises to Abraham and say, God, I need those promises, and have God be faithful to them? Absolutely. If they do not persist in unbelief, they will be grafted in, for God is able to graft them in. And it seems very clear from this passage that God had a plan to do more. You know, Paul's one of them, but there are others, and there will be others that would be grafted in, and beautifully so. And all of this comes down to praise for God. I mean, I've got to notice that, whether I fully process everything or not leading up to it. Paul goes through this whole thing, and it just drives to what a glorious God this is. How deeply wise. Who has ever given him that he has to pay us back? And he just bursts into praise at the end. I think the idea is back to the matter of kindness. We've got to calculate all this, not in terms of my deserving, my superiorities, not especially not me over against another. What happened when God saved me? Kindness. That's what